So, welcome, Andy, to Christie Walk, where I live and where I'm looking forward to doing this interview, which is on Kaurna land, always will be Aboriginal land. And I would like you to introduce yourself, and I think we've got some very interesting topics and human interest topics that we can cover here.
Right. Well, my name is Andy Alcock. I've been involved with East Timor Solidarity since 1975, just before a few months before the Indonesian invasion of that country, and also with West Papua, which is what we're talking about today. But a lot of what I want to cover also involves Indonesia, but also the US, because it was the US that installed the fascist regime in Indonesia that's caused so much bloodshed in our region, and people need to be aware of that.
It was the US that installed it.
Yes, in 1965, the CIA had actually primed General Suharto to be their person.
Okay.
And he actually organised for six generals to be murdered. He then blamed it on the Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI, they were caught unawares. And so they started this huge killing spree. Amnesty says between 500,000 to 1 million people were massacred. But Indonesians, I've met, said the number is nearer 3 million. They also established militias that went out to kill people who were involved with left-wing politics, human rights, unions, that sort of thing. And some of the ways they killed people were just absolutely horrific and sickening. So that's, and of course, for Australia, we've been aiding and abetting this regime ever since. And that's something we have to bear in mind when we talk about East Timor, Aceh and West Papua.
That's a sobering thought, isn't it?
And another sobering thought is that one of the war criminals who was responsible for huge numbers of deaths in both West Papua and East Timor and in Indonesia during the overthrow of the Suharto regime in 1998, Prabowo Subianto, he is now the new president of Indonesia. So that's more food for thought.
It is.
Very scary stuff.
Well, I learned a lot from the information that you sent me, and I'd like to put that up on the page for people, the timelines that you sent me, because it's really interesting. And I'm a bit enthralled with the idea of a bloodless revolution called the Carnation Revolution.
Ah, right. Yes, well, we're talking about what happened in Portugal in 1974. Now, roughly 500 years ago, Portugal occupied East Timor, and it was then called Portuguese Timor. And they also occupied a little enclave in West Timor, which, of course, was colonised by Holland. And that still exists. That agreement still exists. But anyway, for the last 50 years, Portugal had a fascist regime. It had a fascist regime longer than any other government in Europe.
Wow.
And towards the end, the fascist regime was going to build a bridge in the capital of Portugal, Lisbon, Lisboa. And it was going to be dedicated to fascism. However, the army got sick of having to fight colonial wars in East Timor, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and Angola, and they suddenly put on a coup, and they called it the Carnation Revolution because no blood was spilled.
I love that.
and the bridge was dedicated to democracy.
that's so good.
And I've driven over that bridge too in a bus.
I reckon bring on the carnations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And wouldn't we like the carnations in Gaza right now?
Oh, we need thousands of them, millions of them.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And it's what we're talking about is reminiscent, isn't it, of what's happening right now. And while we're laughing about that, Australia's involvement's always been there, but it was people coming in for the spoils, wasn't it, when Portugal pulled out? Other countries coming in to...
Well, that was partly the issue, but another big part of the issue was it was just towards the end of the so-called Cold War. And Indonesia tried to make this big issue about East Timor becoming communist because the major political party that had the major support was Fretilin, the Revolutionary Front for the Liberation of East Timor. They kept putting out that this was going to be a socialist or communist government and blah, blah, blah. And the fact was that there are only a few Marxists in the independence movement, but of course they tried to play it up. Now, Indonesia wanted to get the place, like they got West Papua. They definitely wanted that as well for its resources. But I think America tended to support Indonesia against Timor because of the Cold War, largely, at first. Because the nations that were going to get some of Timor's oil and gas was not America, was going to be Australia and Indonesia. So that's all part of the issue as well.
And that was part of what drove it?
Oh, well, I think the Cold War was the big thing initially. And then what drove it was Australia trying to pinch East Timor's resources. And, of course, it was illegal. The person who played probably one of the largest, there were two. One was Gareth Evans as foreign minister. And he was definitely out to get an agreement with Indonesia, which just happened to be much better for Australia than Indonesia, but it completely locked out any discussion with the Timorese about their resources that were being stolen by these two countries.
And they had no say in it.
They had no say in it at all. And by international law, of course, that is a violation because it is against international law to invade a country and then steal the resources of a people who are being oppressed.
And did that make any difference that it was against the law?
Well, America started more than 90% of the war since World War II, and you'll find that most of them were against international law. They don't care.
Mm.
They just don't care. They do what they want to, regardless of what other nations or what the UN thinks. And of course, we know about the Bulabo Five, the five Australian-based media workers who were murdered in one of the initial attacks by the Indonesian military in October 1975. But on the eve of the full-scale invasion, which was on the 7th of December that year, General Suharto had dinner with Dr. Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford, the President of America. And they both agreed that Indonesia should invade Timor, but they put it on them not to use US armaments because they didn't want to be associated with it. But of course the Indonesians did. They just went ahead and used their armaments. And of course in the next few days after that, we lost another Australian journalist who decided to stay behind, and he features in the film Balibo, and I'm talking about Roger East, who was a very courageous man. Mm. But sadly he didn't get out of Dili in time, and they found him and dragged him onto the wharf and just killed him.
Yeah. As they did many other people.
Well, see, what we have to realise is the Indonesian military's involvement in Timor, occupation of Timor, resulted in a decline of the population of about a third. And a lot of it was starvation as well, because of the Indonesian military attacking farms and rural areas, and so people couldn't get food. But there were many, many massacres over the whole time. Probably the one that's most known about is the Santa Cruz massacre of 1991, and really that contributed to the end of Indonesia's role, even though there were 8 more years of their very brutal rule, but it all helped bring about the end.
And how did it contribute?
Well, it was luck, in fact. In 1989, Pope John Paul went to visit Indonesia and Timor. And as you probably know, when popes go visiting, people joke about the tarmac kissing season. Mm. And when he got to Indonesia, he kissed the tarmac. When he got to East Timor, there was a cushion put on the ground with a cross on it. He knelt down and kissed the cross, but he didn't kiss the ground, which was more or less saying, we accept what's happening. And at the open air mass after, a lot of Timorese were very courageous, and they chanted for independence, and they were very harshly treated as a result of that. The other thing was that there were, after that, by the way, that was when Shirley Shackleton, the widow of Greg Shackleton, one of the Balibo Five, she was actually there for the Pope's visit. And she was at the Turismo Hotel one night for dinner, and there was General Benny Madani, the man who was responsible for the invasion, who probably gave the orders to murder her husband and the other members of the Five. And she went up to him, she was a very plucky person, and she said, "What have you done with my husband?" And they ended up having a bit of a discussion, actually. I thought he would have taken her out and killed her, because I just don't trust Indonesian fascists, and we put it bluntly. But so that happened. That was sort of like the background of what happened in 91. But also the Portuguese Parliament was sending a delegation to Timor in 1990. Oh, the significance of the Pope's visit was that it forced Indonesia to open up the place to the outside world a lot more than what it had been. And so the next year, the parliamentary delegation from Portugal was to go there.
So there were still Portuguese in there, or had they all been...
Only those that had intermarried with the Timorese. No, I don't think there are any Portuguese citizens as such. No. But the delegation was going to see the situation in Timor. And there was a key Australian journalist, Jill Jolliffe, who was in the group of journalists that were accompanying the delegation. And the Indonesian military wouldn't allow her to go because she had done a lot of writing about Timor and she'd been based in Portugal for many years, but advocating for independence for Timor and West Papua. And, she was a very corrupt... Later on, she illegally went into Timor to interview Kona Santana, one of the supreme commanders of Falantil, the resistance.
Wow.
And she did, you know, it was quite amazing. So in the end, it didn't happen. And the Timorese were really psyching themselves up, ready to make a big splash for independence when the Portuguese delegation arrived. And it didn't happen. But what happened was quite a freaky thing. Two Timorese people were murdered in the Mota El Church in Dili. And one was a member of Renatil, which was the civil disobedience student movement for independence. Another one was an Indonesian spy.
Oh.
Anyway, Sebastio Gomez was the name of the Renatil fellow. And when they had a funeral service for him at the church, just as they were getting to the Santa Cruz Cemetery, the funeral march had become a protest march, protesting for independence. And when they got around the corner, the Indonesian military turned their machine guns.
Oh.
And they murdered, in the first instance, 271 people. And unfortunately for them, there was a British filmmaker by the name of Max Stahl, who died just last year, actually, an amazing character. And he got it all down on film. And all every time you see a film cut of that, it's his. He did it. But also there were two American journalists there, David Nairn and... Alan Nairn and Amy Goodman, who does the Democracy Now! Program in the United States. And when the Indonesian military saw them, they were going to shoot them. They copped their weapons to shoot them. And Alan Nairn had the foresight to pull out his passport and hold it up there, and he said, "Those firearms you're going to shoot us with, they're from America, and we're American citizens." And they got very badly bashed. In fact, Alan sustained a fractured skull as a result. That evening, they were on a plane. They went to Hong Kong, and that's when the story broke. And then Max Stahl's film, just amazing how that got out, because he knew that if he had it on him, the soldiers would have picked him up coming out of the cemetery, so he buried it. And he went back at night and dug it up again.
Oh.
And they secreted it out. A person from the, a young woman from the Australian Solidarity Movement, actually punched her nose, got blood on it. She put it on her underclothes. And she stuck the film in her pants, and that's how they got it out. But anyway,
amazing story.
So that made a very big difference. And then the next year, the Portuguese Solidarity Movement hired a vehicle ferry, and the captain of his name, I now forget, was a Swede. And they decided that they would have a protest cruise, and sail to Dili, have a march to the Santa Cruz Cemetery and lay wreaths there. And of course, the world was just amazed by this whole thing. And that was another thing that actually helped keep the Timor issue on the boil. After that, we had the situation where Bishop Bellow and Jose Ramos Horta, who was actually the foreign minister for the provisional revolutionary government of East Timor, were given the Nobel Peace Prize. Mm. That was in 1996. And so Indonesia, this all put lots of pressure on Indonesia. And then in 1998 was the Asian economic meltdown. And because Indonesia had such a corrupt regime, and it just treated its own people like dirt and exploited them terribly. And it just meant that people wanted to get rid of Suharto, because he'd been there since 1965. Mm. And it was when students went out on the streets that Prabowo actually organised Indonesian soldiers to shoot them in the street. So that's another reason why he's considered a war criminal. But then the Indonesian military had never been able to subdue. First Fretilin was the major political party, but was the key resistance in the early days. But in the 80s, there was actually a ceasefire, and they rearranged their whole resistance structure to have a provisional revolutionary government, two parties, political parties, and the Rentetil movement, and that was the whole thing. And the army was called Falantul. So they'd never been able to wipe out Falantul. And a lot of people don't realise, but it's been estimated that at least 40,000 Indonesian soldiers lost their lives during the 24-year occupation of Timor.
And civilians?
I don't think many civilians, but there would have been a few. But yeah, because they didn't. Because what they did in West Papua is what they tried in East Timor. They brought in trans migrants from Java and other parts of Indonesia, and made them plonk them onto Timorese land. And of course, that's what they've done in West Papua, and there are now more Indonesians there than West Papuans. Mm. But most of the civilians, after the UN referendum, which the Timorese won, they left, and they probably feared all sorts of repercussions. But even the traitorous Timorese who supported the Indonesian military and were going out and harassing and murdering people who supported independence, even they've not faced very much problem at all. Mm. Because there's been a big thing on forgiveness and so on. I'm the sort of person who believes people have committed such horrific crimes, they have to face the law. Mm. But Habibie, who took over after Suharto, he could see all of this, and he knew that the Indonesian economy was in a very parlous state, and it was costing them millions to continue this war, and there was no way they were going to defeat Fretilin. The three volunteers. So he decided he'd offer them a deal whereby they could become an autonomous region. That's what the referendum is about. And, of course, the big debate amongst the Timorese was, do we become good Indonesian citizens, or do we become a self-governing part of Indonesia? And, of course, most realised that was hopeless after what they'd suffered for the preceding 24 years. So 78% of the people voted for independence. And that's when the Indonesian military went berserk, along with militias that they created. And another 2,000 people died as a result. And that led to, ironically, a United States president who could see that there was a big problem, Bill Clinton. And he said, oh, look, there should be a peacekeeping force. We had actually been, Bob Haney, the former, longest-serving secretary of the Campaign for an Independent East Timor, and then Australia-East Timor Friendship Association, Dr. Richie Gunn, who was a parliamentarian, they, and myself, we went to meet Alexander Downer because there was just all this killing and mass destruction occurring and nobody was doing anything. So we said, you've got to be calling for a ceasefire and you've got to be calling for a peacekeeping force to go in and stop this. And he didn't seem to be very interested at the time. But ironically, well, I think it was the result of the referendum was the 30th of August, and the Interfet UN peacekeeping force went into Timor on the 12th of September. That all made a big difference. I went to a conference there in 2000 in Bacau, the second largest town in Timor. I met Australian soldiers. We went to a red area, and they wanted to know what we were doing there. And so we got talking to some of the Australian soldiers, and I think they actually loved it because the Timorese were just so grateful because they'd helped ease out the Indonesian military with very little loss of life. And,
just by being there?
Oh, just by having a presence, but by being very assertive and pushing them out. Because the Indonesian military, I met a fellow in Adelaide from the West Papuan OPM, the Free Papua Movement, and he described, because he was a guerrilla fighter, and he said that they spent a lot of their time harassing military convoys. And he described one attack on a convoy, and he said the Indonesian soldiers just refused to stay and fight, and they ran, and he said there was this amazing situation where one of the soldiers had his submachine gun on his shoulder and he was firing behind
him.
So, you know, they were never going to be very brave. They were always like just going and mass murdering civilians. And you know, we've got to remind ourselves, Australia was supporting them, in doing this. Both the Liberal and National parties and the ALP. You know, it's a very disgraceful history.
And for what reason would they support that?
Well, I've got a theory that allies of the US have to support client states of the US. And one of those client states is Indonesia. I mean, it was put there by the CIA. With the help of the TNI, the Indonesian military.